everyone. My name is Troy Heifecker. I'm the Deputy Forest Supervisor on the Tongass National Forest. I'm out of Ketchikan. I've been in this position for going on 2 years now. I've been with the Forest Service for 22 years, and I spent 14 of those in working here in Southeast Alaska. I'd like to start the night by acknowledging the people who were here on these lands before us, the Alaska Natives. Thank you for allowing us to be here on your lands, allowing us to share the stewardship of this land. We take that responsibility very seriously, and thank you again for having us here. I would like to thank everyone else for showing up tonight, taking time away from your lives and your families and businesses and taking the time and opportunity to come and engage with us. Appreciate that. The agenda tonight, we're gonna work through here is we'll have a little bit of an overview on where we are in the road this rule process, how we got here, and the next steps, and provide some information on how you can participate in the public process. We'll go through a presentation on the roadless rule, give some information on all the alternatives, including the proposed and the preferred alternative at this point, and some ways that you can get more further information and then provide comments and participate in this process. Once that concludes, we'll take a little break, hopefully, and then we'll reconvene and we'll have an ANILCA 810 subsistence hearing. That's currently scheduled to start at 7 o'clock. We have it booked through 9, and we'll be here until there's no one else left to testify. We ask that you sign up, and we can get those scheduled. In the sign-up, there was a little box to circle if you want to testify or not. Safety. You guys probably know this building better than I do. There's an emergency exit in the back, it looks like, that goes outside, I would assume. Down.
This is going to lead down to a stairwell, goes right out to South Murray Drive.
Thank you, sir. Another exit here, the way we came in. Bathrooms are around the corner. Again, thank you for your participation. Really appreciate it. I'm going to hand it over to Dave for further information.
I see some folks are still coming in, but we'll start rolling ahead here. But thank you all, and welcome here tonight. This is like our fourth stop on a trip here through Southeast and interacting with folks. It's great to be back in Petersburg. This is one of my favorite spots in Southeast as well. So just a little bit about me. I arrived here about a year and a half ago as the regional forester in Alaska, but wasn't new to Alaska. I spent about 24 years working up here, both on the Chugach National Forest and down on Prince of Wales here on the Tongass as well. And so, and part of my impetus coming back here was really an opportunity and a commitment to the rural communities. I lived in rural Alaska all that time, and like many of you, practiced in a subsistence lifestyle and had the privilege to do that. But when I arrived here exactly the same week, a year ago, April or so, prior to that, our former governor, State Governor Walker, had petitioned the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, for Alaska as an exemption to the roadless rule, the 2001 rule. And that week that I showed up was the week that Sonny Perdue, our secretary, accepted the petition, but also with a little bit of a different twist than was asked for originally, and that was to try and find a path forward here in Alaska. As many of you know and have worked with the roadless rule, I was a ranger in 2001. It's had a history. It's been exempted. It's been litigated. We're still in litigation, actually, with the state back in Washington, D.C. on a case here. And for the last several years, the roadless rule has applied to the Tongass. And so the secretary had asked the agency to try and move forward and try and craft a state-specific rule that might work for Alaska, recognizing that Alaska is unique, the Tongass especially is unique. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight, but maybe patterned after a couple of other state-specific rules. I got to work my last job with Idaho. The state of Idaho has a state-specific roadless rule, as does Colorado. In fact, our IDT interdisciplinary team leader, who's here tonight and has been working, was was on that Colorado team, and I think that's how he got drafted here to Alaska as well. And so we started out after that petition was accepted. We got together with the state of Alaska. One of the actions working with the state was to have, and actually the state did this, was formed an advisory group throughout Southeast Alaska here to help inform the state's position that they would offer to the Forest Service as well. I know we've got a state representative tonight. Tim Dabney's here somewhere, and he's not on the menu or on the agenda, but Tim is here. If you have a chance and have questions about some of that, I'm sure he'd be happy to address those. But so we did sign an agreement with the state. We signed a memorandum of understanding and working as a cooperating agency, and that the state would conduct that process. Was anyone in here on that board or on that process? We've had a few members around, but they did conduct informational meetings throughout Southeast. We also, for the first time, I sent a letter out to all of the tribes in Southeast, the federally recognized tribes, to see if they wanted to also sign on as a cooperating agency in this effort. And I don't think that's happened here. We've done that in other places in the lower 48. And six tribes took up that offer and signed on and have provided input as well into the alternative development that we'll talk about tonight, and especially one alternative that they really focused in on as well. We also went out with a scoping effort, and I think we hosted meetings. I know we hosted meetings here in Petersburg and about 16 other communities, and asking for input on what people thought about the roadless rule and the important parts of that. And so at that time, I think the Forest Service, we received 140-some thousand comments back from the public as a result of those meetings and information that was set out. And then also, obviously, our secretary works in this administration. He's appointed and confirmed, appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And they've had lots of interaction with our state elected representatives and other folks. And so there's several groups and means that input came into this effort. And meanwhile, over the last year or so, we've had folks working on a draft environmental impact statement and then the proposed rules that would go along with that. And so where we're at in the process here right now is we did just release about 2 or 3 weeks ago a draft of the environmental impact statement and a proposed rule. The secretary has indicated his preference at this time based on all of that information that he received to go out with a preferred or preference for alternative six and a proposed rule, which is an exemption. And we'll talk about those alternatives and how they're kind of bookended. But that was released along with the proposed rule, and that started a 60-day comment period. And we made a commitment, certainly with our initial meetings and work we've had, to get back to all the communities that, and more now, that we reached out to early, to provide as much information as we can and help people comment in the most effective way that folks can here. And so we're about 2 weeks in. I think the comment period closes December 17th, and we'll have an opportunity between now and then. So we've gotten out early, and that's kind of where we're at in the process at this point. And we're just going to hold questions, if I could, for a bit. And at this time, what we'd like to do, we're going to have a big question and answer period, but I'm going to turn over to Ken. What we'd like to do is just get through this so everyone working from the same set of information. We'll go into question and answer. We should have about an hour for question and answer in here as well. And then, as Troy said, we'll break. During that break, as we get ready for a subsistence hearing as well, we'll have an 8:10 hearing here. We'll also be available during that time one-on-one. Sometimes folks are more comfortable just having one-on-one discussion. But that's kind of the plan. And so at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Ken Tu, and I already started to introduce him. He's not from Alaska, but I saw today he got upgraded. He's been back and forth on Alaska Airlines. I think he's MVP Gold already.
Yeah, he's been up here a lot. Thank you, Dave. Like Dave said, my name is Ken Tu. I'm the interdisciplinary team leader for this rulemaking effort, and I am from Denver, and never lived in Alaska, but I am a process manager, so don't worry too much. So let's see. I'll come this way. There we go. So our objective tonight is to provide a base understanding of the proposed Alaska Worldless Rule, the associated draft environmental impact statement, and then also how to get involved in the remaining portion of this rulemaking effort. And as Dave said, there's kind of our schedule that we have laid out for the evening. Okay, so what is rulemaking? Rulemaking is a process in which federal agencies follow to develop or change a federal regulation. And a federal regulation is part of our hierarchy of direction that agencies must follow. The very top direction that we have are statutes or laws. And as you know, only Congress can pass a law. A regulation is very similar to a law. A regulation, and that's what we're doing, is we're proposing to develop a regulation. A regulation is similar to a law in that it has the force of law, meaning an agency, once it's promulgated, an agency does not have the discretion not to meet a law or a regulation. As another part of our hierarchy of direction is force policy or agency policy, and probably most of you are familiar with one of our main policy documents, which is a forest plan. And that's subordinate to laws and regulations, meaning implementation of a forest plan must be consistent with all applicable statutes and regulations. In this rulemaking process, we have two procedural laws that we're following. One is the Administrative Procedure Act, and that's a process in which federal agencies must follow to issue a regulation. It does have a required public comment process. We had one last year, and then we're in the other required process, public comment process right now. There's also two major documents that are produced through the Administrative Procedure Act process. One is the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. That's the document that Dave mentioned that we released about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was October 18th or 17th. And that describes our proposal as well as the rationale for our proposal. Second document's the final rule. That will describe the what rule is actually selected and the rationale for that. We hope to have that final rule completed by next summer. The other procedural act that we must follow is the National Environmental Policy Act. That is a process which federal agencies must follow to consider and disclose potential environmental impacts of any federal action. And in this case, the federal action is the development of an Alaska-specific roadless rule. And once again, the National Environmental Policy Act has a required public involvement process, and those align they're aligned exactly the same as the APA public involvement processes. There's three major documents that we'll produce under the National Environmental Policy Act associated with this project. One is the draft environmental impact statement, which we released October 18th, and is available for your review, and describes the alternatives and the potential impacts. The other one is the final environmental impact statement. What we'll do is, based on public comments received during the 60-day comment period, we'll adjust our draft environmental impact statement and incorporate your concerns and comments into that. And we hope to have the final environmental impact statement released. We plan to have that done late spring or early summer next year. And then lastly, there's a record of decision, and that describes our decision, and it'll be issued in conjunction with the final rule. And like I said before, that'll be summer of 2020. Not very good at this thing. So this whole thing started with the promulgation of the 2001 Roldis Rule. It's officially known as the Roldis Area Conservation Rule, and also known as the National Roldis Rule. And it was promulgated specifically to protect and conserve inventory of roadless areas throughout the country. It did this by prohibiting timber harvest, road construction, and road reconstruction within inventory of roadless areas. And when the 2001 rule was promulgated, it applied to 58.5 million acres across the nation. And out of those 58.5 million acres, 15.5 million acres were within Alaska, with about 5.4 million on the Chugach National Forest and 9.2 on the Tongass National Forest. So what is an inventory of roadless area? It's generally greater than 5,000 acres. They normally do not have roads, timber harvest, or other development within them. They do not include congressionally designated roadless areas, which comprise about one-third of the national forest system. In addition, the 2001 Roldis Rule describes 9 roadless area characteristics that are often found within inventory roadless areas. And I'm not going to read them off, but those are the 9 right there that the 2001 Roldis Rule define. And I'll get more into that here in a minute. So, in January 2018, the state of Alaska petitioned the Secretary of Agriculture for state-specific, or to exempt the Tongass National Forest from the 2001 Roldis Rule. They cited economic development opportunities as the reason for that. And as you know, the Tongass National Forest, and as Dave mentioned, it's a unique place. It's unique in its size. At 16.7 million acres, the Tongass National Forest is the largest national forest in the national forest system. In addition, what makes it unique is the percent of roadless areas within the national forest. As I said earlier, it's 9.2 million acres on the Tongass are roadless, or about 55% of the Tongass is considered roadless. In addition, local community dependence on the Tongass makes it very unique. About 80% of Southeast Alaska is comprised of the Tongass National Forest. In addition, there's 32 communities throughout Southeast Alaska that are surrounded by National Forest System lands. So clearly that makes anything that occurs on the Tongass National Forest extremely influential on those local communities. And lastly, the Tongass National Forest has unique statutory considerations, specifically the Tongass Timber Reform Act and the Alaska National Lands Interest Conservation Act. So after the state petitioned the secretary, the Department of Agriculture looked at it and felt that a state-specific roadless rule would be a good platform to develop a long-term durable solution to address Alaska's unique social, ecological, and economic issues as it relates to roadless area management. So in August 2018, the Forest Service issued a notice of intent to prepare an EIS that initiated the rulemaking process. It also initiated a 45-day comment period that lasted through mid-October of last year. And as Dave said, we received 144,000 comments during that time period. And after the public comment period ended, we utilized those comments as well as input from the cooperating agencies and tribes to develop alternatives to respond to those concerns. And we spent about a year doing that. And then in October of 2019, we issued the notice of availability to for the proposed rule and the draft environmental impact statement, which initiated the 60-day public comment period that we're in right now. And it ends in December 17th, as mentioned before. So, alternative six, the full exemption, that is the proposed rule and the preferred alternative in the draft environmental impact statement. And what the proposed rule does, or alternative six, it exempts all 9.2 million acres on the Tongass National Forest from the 2001 Norwich Rule. So that means there's no regulatory prohibitions on timber harvest, road construction, or road reconstruction within the inventory roadless areas. However, that doesn't mean that anybody can build roads and harvest timber anywhere within there, because any future activities on the Tongass would be primarily guided by the land management plan, as well as the suite of other applicable environmental laws, regulations, and agency policies. Also, this Alaska Roadless Rule, it leaves the Chugach National Forest intact in terms of the 2001 Roadless Rule. So the 2001 Roadless Rule would apply to 99% of the Chugach National Forest. However, we did add an administrative correction and modification, boundary modification procedure into the Alaska specific rule to allow for changes to boundaries. And, you know, through almost 20 years of implementing the 2001 Roadless Rule, we found that there was a need to have a fairly efficient manner to make these changes. A lot of them were errors. And a lot of them, you just need to move the boundary, you know, 300 feet to put a road in for, you know, some important project. So, and rather than going through a full-blown rulemaking process to move that boundary, we created this administrative process to do that. And this process does not mean you could wholesale change roadless area boundaries and drop all the roadless areas on the Chugach. That would be such a significant change that that would require another rulemaking. Another alternative we looked at is the no action alternative, alternative one. This is required by the National Environmental Policy Act. And this really retains the status quo. So the 2001 roadless rule would remain in place on the Chugach and Tongass National Forests without any changes. And this alternative one and six are what we kind of framed up and called the bookends to our range of alternatives. We also developed some other alternatives, alternatives two through five, which you know, were based off of the public input that we had received. And so the way we did that is we looked at those 144,000 comments, and we identified what we considered the key issues, what was the public really concerned about. And we distilled it down to three key issues. One was conserving roadless characteristics. The other was supporting community socioeconomic well-being, which includes Alaska Native cultural uses and concerns, and then also rural subsistence lifestyle effects. And then lastly, the last key issue we identified was conserved terrestrial habitat, aquatic habitat, and biological diversity. We used these three key issues to kind of frame up our analysis, as well as help guide the development of our alternatives. So alternatives two through five, we had to think about how were we going to respond to these issues and basically reimagine how to manage roadless areas within the Tongass. And we did this by developing five what we call roadless area management categories, and going from most restrictive, the watershed priority, to least restrictive, timber priority. We developed those purely on input, and then we applied them differentially across the alternatives. And the watershed priority, that management category was developed in response to what we heard was concerns for fisheries and as well as water quality. And so what we did is we made that more restrictive than the 2001 Roebuck Rule. That means we have less exceptions that could occur, less activities that could occur within certain areas that we designated as watershed priority. And we applied these watershed priorities to key watersheds that were identified in the 2016 forest plan. And those areas were known as the Tonga 77, as well as the Nature Conservancy Audubon Society conservation areas. We also applied what we call LUD 2 priority. LUD stands for land use designation. And LUD 2 priority areas are, well, LUD 2 areas are statutory defined areas which by law we have to manage for wildland character. And wildland character is very similar to roadless area management. So we have the statutory direction which we have to follow, and then we have this overlay of roadless rule direction which is similar but different. And that got kind of confusing for a lot of managers, as well as the public. And so rather than having both direction, we just went and tried to distill that down to the statutory direction. And that's what the LUD 2 priority is kind of represents. The roadless priority management category, that's the most similar to the 2001 roadless rule. It is a little bit less restrictive than the 2001 roadless rule in that we heard from many communities that they wanted a certain level of infrastructure development for community connections as well as development for power sources. And so we allowed that as well as Native American cultural uses. So that roadless priority allows those activities. Also in community use priority, that is a little bit less restrictive than roadless priority. And we did that based on certain communities describing a great desire for other, you know, more infrastructure development, things for recreation, again, community connections, as well as utilities and that sort of thing. And they also expressed a desire for some limited amount of timber harvest across the landscape. However, they did not want the large-scale timber harvest from the 90s and 2000s to be near their community. So we put a constraint on there to allow only small timber sales. And then timber priority is the least restrictive, and that allows timber harvest road construction within roadless areas. And like I said, we applied those differentially across the alternatives. We applied watershed priority to alternatives 2 and 3. We applied the community priority only to alternative 3. We applied the timber priority only to alternative 4. And the LUD 2 priority to alternatives 2, 4, and 5. And then kind of the rest of the areas, kind of the matrix, received the roadless priority. And alternatives 2, 3, 4, and 5 received that. And then alternative 6 has no management categories because it would be driven not by a roadless rule, but by the forest plan. So like I said earlier, there's the roadless area characteristics that were defined by the 2001 roadless rule. The Citizen Advisory Committee that informed the state's input looked at those 9 characteristics and felt that they weren't reflective of Southeast Alaska. So they provided the Forest Service with, well, they provided the state, who provided it to the Forest Service, a different set of language that was more reflective of Southeast Alaska. And so we adopted those, and we had to change it slightly because the way the Forest Service uses these wilderness area characteristics is during project planning. This is how we evaluate impacts to wilderness areas, is through the 9 characteristics. So in alternatives 2, 3, 4, and 5, we would adopt the recommendations from the state on that. So to go in a little bit more detail on the other alternatives, alternative 2 is what, this is the least or the most restrictive of the action alternatives. And it provides a limited amount of additional timber harvest opportunity. And we did this by basically not undesignating what we call roaded roadless areas. And these are roadless areas that have existing roads in them. There's about 110,000 acres of those across the Tongass National Forest. And we also applied the watershed priority, the Tongass 77 and the Nature Conservancy Audubon conservation areas to that alternative. And we applied the LUD 2 management category to that. And the rest of the areas received the roadless priority designation. Alternative 3 is very similar to alternative 2, except for with a little bit more additional timber harvest opportunity. And we did that by also not designating or dropping roaded roadless areas from roadless designation. We also dropped from roadless designation what we call the logical extensions. Those were the areas adjacent to the roaded roadless areas that we felt were most likely to be developed based on the proximity to roads. And we basically took it up to the next watershed boundary. There's about 210,000 of those acres, the logical extension acres. And then we also applied the watershed community, the watershed priority to this alternative. In addition, we applied to all the Tongass 77 and Audubon conservation areas. We applied a no old growth harvest, whether it was in or out of a roadless area, to protect those key watersheds. We also applied this community priority management category. And then the rest of the area received the roadless priority. So this community use priority, like I said before, you know, it was there to allow for certain level, small scale level of infrastructure development and for Alaska Native cultural uses, as well as small-scale timber harvest. And as I said before, that was up to 1 million board feet per timber cell. And we applied it to areas that were where the municipal government or the tribal government or a nonprofit community association, as defined by Alaska statute, requested, you know, some additional flexibility around their community. And we applied it to Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, Wrangell, Yakutat, and we didn't have enough time to apply it to Cape and Heidelberg, but we will between draft and final. And if another community asks us to apply it during the comment period, we'll apply it between draft and final to those communities. Alternative 4 allows more timber harvest opportunities. And we did this by taking from the forest plan the land use designations, specifically the timber development and modified landscape land use designations identified in the forest plan. We gave that the timber priority, meaning you could harvest timber and build roads within inventory roadless areas that had that designation. We also dropped the areas with the logical extensions and the roaded roadless to this alternative. And then we applied the LUD 2 priority, and then the rest of the area received the roadless priority. Alternative 5, this is a little bit more. This is probably the least restrictive of the non-bookend alternatives. And this, we just essentially dropped from roadless designation the development LUDs identified in the forest plan. And that was the timber development, the modified landscape, and the scenic view shed land use designations. And those would not be in roadless areas, and they wouldn't be, there would be no constraint, regulatory constraint on activities there. In addition, we have identified in the 2016 forest plan an overlay in which we identified areas with potential mineral activity. And we dropped those areas from roadless area designation also in alternative 5. This alternative 5 is, we kind of adopted this based on the public input or the input from the state, from the Citizen Advisory Committee. So this is very similar to one of the Citizen Advisory Committee options. So we have a range of alternatives going from the no action alternative, 9.2 million acres, all the way to 0 acres with alternative 6 in roadless areas. As you can see, alternative 2 has a little bit more acres than the no action. That's because in addition to dropping the roaded roadless from roadless designation, we added some roadless areas based on the previous inventories, as well as the small islands that were not designated in the 2001 roadless roll. So we have a range of impacts along with those range of alternatives. And obviously with the alternative 1, the no action alternative, there's no effect because there's no change. And then alternative 6, which is the most impactful alternative. And you might look at that and you see like minimal beneficial effect and minimal adverse effect to terrestrial habitat. And you might think that we totally got that wrong. But the reason you don't see a wide range of effects that you would kind of expect with a something that supposedly opens up 9.2 million acres is because the forest plan direction still remains intact. So the potential sale quantity of 46 million board feet per year that's identified in the 2016 forest plan, that wouldn't change. We'd still just cut up to that level. And then in addition, the old growth or the young growth transition strategy would remain in place, as well as all the standards and guidelines that apply in the forest plan. They would apply in alternative 6. So we have two websites that have additional information. We have a general one on the right, and the one on the left is our project website, which has all our public documents for this project loaded up on there. As well as we have a story map online tool, and that is a tool that allows you to zoom into a specific area, and it has all the alternatives on there. Probably most important is the tab on the right. That one on the right allows you to turn on and turn off various data layers, as well as turning on and off multiple alternatives, and allows you to zoom in. So there's multiple ways to comment. You can comment through regulations.gov. You can comment through our project website, which is probably the best way to do it. Or you can mail hard copies to that address. We also have an email address you can send things to. Or you can just give us written comments today, and we will take them and get them into the record. So the next steps, the comment period ends December 17th. up to that point, we'll be holding public meetings throughout Southeast Alaska and in Anchorage and D.C. And after the public comment period closes, we'll start working on the FEIS. Tribal and Alaska Native Corporation consultation will be ongoing, as well as any public outreach activities. We will continue to do that throughout the process. And like I said before, final environmental impact statement, we plan to get that out late spring, early summer of next year. Then the Secretary of Agriculture will take a look at everybody's comments and decide which alternative to select as the final rule. And then we will issue the final rule in next summer.
I'm turning it back over. Take a breath.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's hard.
Yeah.
I appreciate you catching through there. But at this point in time, and maybe Ted, although Ted, our ranger, can help me with his questions to keep track of folks, but we'd just like to open it up on thoughts or questions around what you heard tonight and what you're thinking. So
Dave, before you start, excuse me, if everybody didn't know, there's a lot of information on the back cubby here. That's where you can go if you didn't have a comment. You know, there's a lot of information there that will help you give comments to us.
With 144,000 comments that you guys received, I've heard that over 90% of them were in favor of keeping the roadless rule in place. So how did you come up with alternative 6 as your priority alternative, or your preferred alternative? I mean, it just kind of makes you think, well, this whole process is an absolute sham. You got the public's opinion in the scoping. Why did you go forward when the public so overwhelmingly said, hey, this is working?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. A very fair and good question. We received 144,000 comments. I'll ask how many were
in form letters?
Form letters as well.
About 143,000.
About 143,000. So there's part of it. There's a lot of people that care. There's a lot of people that put information out there. I think I can't speak for the secretary, but he does listen to others. As I shared to begin with, there were the state's advisory process, which I think landed somewhere around 5, but the elected officials here in Alaska, certainly, I'm sure that he weighed some of that differently and how he came up with that. I would remind everyone, and we wouldn't be up here, I certainly wouldn't be up here, if I didn't think there's some room in between those two alternatives that we should and want to be hearing from folks at this point in time.
You guys couldn't get Rudy Giuliani to come in for this meeting tonight? I mean, I was kind of expecting him to be here, to tell you the truth, because I feel this is a corrupt process.
Can you help me with that? I can't see. Please.
I'm going to respond to the comment that you are a process man, and I will say I am a paradigm woman. Process is built on paradigm. I'm wondering if we can ever get to the point where we talk about the use of the natural world or something other than economics. It is a sacred place. The world grew what it has before men were ever involved. We do not need to manage nature. We need to leave nature alone.
Thank you. I appreciate your opinion.
I've heard the form letter defense for over 30 years. I originally started the Forest Service here in Pierce. And I would just remind you that most election ballots would be form letters, and they're all count the same.
We did count the 100. We look at those. I agree. We did count those in the 144,000.
But don't discount them because there's one letter. That'd be a major disservice to the public involvement process.
Yes, I don't know how many we've received so far on...
We've gotten about 80,000.
80,000 here in the first couple of weeks, so there are a lot of people that care about the Congress.
Jimmy.
I'm going to rely on it.
I didn't take it as a definite one side or the other. You got six different options. I'm assuming we're going to land somewhere in there just out of natural thing. I want to know sustainability-wise to get harvesting and economics where we can get to a spot where we can go back and start reharvesting again. What option would we need to do with the present stuff that we got to get to that point so we're not having this continual battle so we can get to the 75-year cycle where we can go back and start harvesting again and everything's pretty well set. This is what we're harvesting. These are the natural lands. They're going to stay that way forever because we're in a cycle now. What one of those options gets us to that point where we have the ability to do that?
So let me try and answer if I don't get it right. So one of the things I think Ken mentioned near the end is the underlying, he started out, and I struggled with some of it, but we've got these laws and Congress makes, and we've got the regulation. This is a regulation, and we have the policies. So right now, the forest plan on the Tongass that was amended and completed, updated in 2016, that's the underlying management direction. Part of that plan and a piece of that was a transition to a young growth strategy. And so that still stays the same in all of the alternatives, unless the forest plan were to change. And that, I know folks just got together recently here updating on some of the inventory work, and that's estimated a 12 to 15 year transition period. We've been offering some second growth, young growth sales. So that would be at this point common to all alternatives.
I guess my question is, does the room the sack the way it is, does it hinder that so we can't even go back and start reharvesting in that cycle, or do we need to make changes to make that happen?
No, there are some acres that are of young growth that are in roadless. There are lots of acres that are in the beach fringe that the plan wouldn't allow us to go into. So as I understand it, and I use rough numbers, so take them as rough numbers, maybe 450,000 acres on the Tongass have been harvested over its history. About half of that, roughly, might be available in young growth with the current standards and guidelines that we have in beach and some of the areas it's in. So, roughly.
So the our analysis indicates also that alternative six, the full exemption alternative, actually facilitates the transition to young growth. It may sound counterintuitive, but the reason why is because you have the additional 20,000 acres of young growth in there, and then also it provides additional flexibility for some of those old growth acres during that transition period.
I was going to address Brandon over here. I think he answered this before. What seems to be the problem with PIA's tribal membership getting involved with this? Were we not able to get any interest? Or
yeah, they did. Go ahead. Yeah, the council didn't do anything. They didn't comment.
They didn't comment?
No.
I'm commenting. I'm here. Thank you.
And remind everyone, we'll stay as long as we certainly can tonight, but having lived in rural Alaska, and I know access to resources are really important, and so we will have a hearing here as well that will be recorded, and folks can certainly share there. I'm sorry. I'm going to let Ted do this.
Go ahead.
I can't see you.
Thanks, Ted. So I'm sure most of us are familiar with Southeast Conference's economic reports. The last several of their reports have placed the value of the timber industry at less than 1% of the total revenues industry is bringing into the region. And I would just, put an asterisk by industry. We're talking about Alcan and Viking primarily, right? Certainly many of us in here are fish and are involved in visitor industries, and these are, as a lot of people say, kind of the twin engines of the region at this point, really powering our economy, certainly in Petersburg. We don't have a mill. not that, I mean, we have small mills that we all use. We appreciate those, absolutely. But for export, you know, we're talking about, we don't do that here. So my question is, the selection of alternative six, who does that benefit in Southeast Alaska?
So I, let me try and answer it one way. When the state petitioned, the reasoning behind petitioning for an exemption was not just with timber. They did cite a number of other areas, from hydropower development to mining to other activities. And granted, most of those activities have exemptions or the ability to exempt from the roadless rule. We've done it quite a bit.
Yeah.
The thinking in what was petitioned was that while there may be room for exemption, that the actual project would cost more, would be more expensive to conduct, and that it might be harder to do, and it might detract other investments, and that people would just shy away. That was some of the rationale behind that. Obviously, it benefits folks that are looking for more access into different places in the forest. From the timber side,
more access?
More access, I think, that people would see.
I'm unsure.
Recreational access.
You mean driving?
Variety, yes. Driving, hunting, gathering, looking for more access that have identified that. From the timber side of it, I do know, and so as Ken talked about, the underlying plan is still our PTSQ or whatever, our sale quantity is limited to 46 million per year per the plan. We haven't been doing that much. But what it does from the industry is they're looking at other areas that give more room to operate in for that same volume than where we're at off existing areas. So there's definitely a benefit to that.
High grading? High grading?
I don't know about high grading. More opportunity in other places to operate.
Joe, did you want to say?
I couldn't help but notice in the presentation, which was pretty thorough, that there's not one mention about this plan and whichever one's chosen except for the no action and its effect on climate change in Southeast Alaska. Because I don't know how much you guys spend on the water or out and about, but this place is literally crashing all around us. The ocean temperatures are just going right out the window. And it rained for almost 2 months straight. When it did finally rain, I could have just about spit and pissed as big a puddle as what that little rain was in the middle of those 2 months. It was just, it almost evaporated as soon as it hit the ground. And this was down in the Craig vicinity. A lot of trees died here just over that sun, and I've been watching them go on the small rocky islands. Now, one peep about climate change in this plan, although I did see on June 30th, federal government, prompted by you-know-who, some gobbledygook, new plans don't have to consider climate change anymore. They have some. If this is 4 inches and this is 2 inches, well, two's almost as good as four. Some strange equivocation of there's no harm, same way there's been no cumulative impact for years. One more thing to add to it, when you mentioned the 400,000 acres plus of clear cuts, that's only on federal lands. And there's this, been this shell and pea game for about the last 35 years. Only for this many acres in there. We have tens of thousands of native acres of clear cuts from corporations, and I don't know if Seed Alaska might be the best, but when you add those to the mix, you're looking at a lot more than 400,000.
You're right.
It's just got to be considered if we're really as thorough as all this is. But where's the climate change?
I certainly agree that this year unprecedented. We had conditions,
and
it's been
the last 4 years, mm-hmm. of the last 10 years, each year hotter than the next.
It's been changing. We experienced, like I said, unprecedented. We had fires in places that we would never experience.
We have Sirius Radio on our boat. They had a scientific panel about the effect of trees on climate change. One of the scientists said, well, it's a no-brainer that we shouldn't be cutting any more old-growth trees. I said to my wife, yeah, it's a no-brainer everywhere except Alaska. And somehow we just haven't skipped over to, well, where's the beef?
I appreciate the comment.
So let me just describe something. So one of the reasons we didn't analyze climate change in this document is because we feel that really it's a wash, because it doesn't matter whether you harvest, you know, 46 million board feet here versus 46 million board feet there, the effect is the same. So from, you know, in context of this roller school and the status quo, it's the amount of volume that's coming off the Tongass that affects the carbon sink. And if you're removing 46 million board feet in alternative six versus alternate one, it's the same impact to the carbon sink.
It doesn't change your comment, it's just how it's addressed.
That's how I don't see how it's the same impact. You're talking about young growth pulling up the thing, because young growth trees have no value for years and decades.
Like I said, you know, the young growth transition strategy still remains in place. So the amount of, roughly the same amount of old growth, young growth, it's going to be pretty close to what we plan to harvest in the next 15 years. And matter of fact, we might even get to the young growth quicker with alternative six.
So Dan, you were next.
Just a quick, I had to double back on the exemptions. Tell me if I'm wrong. The number of exemptions that have been requested, I understand that most of those have been approved, is that correct? So exemptions don't appear to be much of a hindrance to communities.
Yes, I've shared that broadly. So we have, we've approved, I think, pretty much every exemption that has come in. What we hear, what you might hear, is that there are other projects that never get that far. That's what we've been told, is that there are other challenges they see along the way. And so the projects that make it to my desk, or the ones that cheats to my desk, have all been approved.
I've been through the public process from the original TILO in 79 to now, and I don't think I've ever seen you guys between a bigger hard spot in the rock. And the only real difference I see is that you're getting direction right from the top, right from the secretary. So my question is to you, what is there anything in writing that you guys have gotten from the secretary telling you that the preferred alternative is going to be the total exemption?
I don't know that it was in writing. He did indicate that preference, yes. Yes.
How?
That came down through a chain, a few people above me. I'd have to find that out.
Above your pay grade? Regional forester?
Yeah, down through the department, through the secretary, under secretary, oversee our agency.
Do any of you have the numbers offhand comparing the CO2 oxygen output between a decaying old growth forest, a 35-year-old reprod forest, and the algae in the ocean?
You got me on that one. I'd have to ask somebody more than I. Yeah.
Yeah. Same answer that.
So I guess I'd just like to address the form letter again, and you know, the fact that I'm not a scientist, and I don't actually, I have some time extra in my day, but not a lot. I'm a single mother working, and so I kind of depend on you guys to give us the information and comments about the CO2. You know, our forest is holding a lot of that, and, you know, as I understand it, and I really think your scientists should be talking more about it. We haven't heard it here at all. I mean, even a little bit would have helped us, but I think that argument alone would go a long way for you. And, you know, know, just to address that, how you get your, you know, command from above. I feel like we don't really have anything to say. We can't really invite against that. You people at the top making decisions compared to the 150,000 comments that are getting from people that mm-hmm. aren't too busy to send a form. Mm-hmm. If you multiply that by probably, you know, 10 mm-hmm. by the number of people who would be interested if they actually had time to figure it out and make a comment.
Mm-hmm. No, all good points. I think all good points. We did look at 144,000 comments in ours. I go back to the beginning again and talk about it. So we have, I think every governor since 2001 has advocated and asked for an exemption, each state administration. I think I cannot speak for the secretary. I do know that he was a state governor and he does listen very closely to the states, and so I would suspect when he hears from the four highest elected officials, he's gonna put a lot of weight there. And I think this process, and like I said before, I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe in the process that people and you all can affect change if you don't feel, and if there is a folks that want to influence something other than the full exemption. That's why we're here.
So we should write a letter that's not a form letter.
That was-